Hello and welcome back. Thank you very much for coming back. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Doing fine.
Good. The question that's just quickly popped into my head, which was part of the conversation we had after we'd finished recording, because I said to you, I'd just love to have you back on. And you said to me, I'm used to that. Everybody would just wants me to keep talking about it.
It's like nonstop. Just keep going. As much time as you need, keep going. It's a subject that does it.
Yes, it's just, I realized as when we were talking, I didn't realize how much of a fanboy I was, because there's nothing nice about it. The more I read the book, and like you said, or the more I read the book, it's, and there's, like you said, there's a lot of stuff you leave out, but you kind of leave a read in between the lines, no pun intended, you can tell where it ended up or what happened. And yet you just it's in you're just engrossed and like fascinated as if this is some sort of life to aspire to.
Well, that sometimes, occurs with the movies and television because it's for entertainment. And because when you make something for entertainment, you don't realize there's a lot of hard work and it's, not always going to be how you want it to be. And especially if you're dealing in a criminal life, you don't know what the consequences are. You think everything is just a glamorous life and everything looks great. And it doesn't always work out that way. Not at all. I was talking with a couple last night in the restaurant. They're from England, and they asked me, the first question they asked me was, "You know anything about the Marlboro Diamond heist?" And I said, "I sure do. I sure do." So we talked for about 2.5 hours in the restaurant on that subject.
It is. Explain to people about the heist.
Well, basically, what it was two Chicago mobsters. It was Jerome Joseph Jerome Scalise and Arthur, who's called himself the Brain Rachel, and they had gone to London, and they were basically jewel thieves. Though Scalise later got involved in what was known as the Wild Bunch in the 70s, which was involved in a mob war between the two factions in the Chicago out in the outfit, Far South Side. Known as the Chicago Heights crew. One guy was trying to take over the crew, and there was internal fighting. So Scalise was involved in some murders. But what they did was they registered in a hotel in London, and the Marlboro Diamond is 42 carats. Though it's still not 42 carats, but at that time it was 42 carats because it was cut up. And they dressed up as sheiks, okay, from a Middle Eastern country. And they went into the jewelry store where the diamond was and kind of distracted the guy a little bit, grabbed it and ran, and then got into a cab and went back to the hotel and put on their street clothes. And the question is obviously is what happened to the diamond? And from my best recollection, I can say is that it was given to the cab driver who took him to the airport, and it was mailed. They asked the cab driver to mail this package. And it went to Rachel's sister. She lives in New York. I'm not sure if it's New York City or upstate New York. And but the problem was for them was they weren't quiet about it, because when they got off the airplane at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, the FBI was waiting for them. So obviously one of the two had talked to a CI, which is a confidential informant. That's different than a CW. People get that confused. They think it's the same. A CW, confidential witness, is someone who's going to be indicted, okay, and decides to flip. That's a confidential witness. The confidential informant is someone who can be on the FBI payroll and is giving them information, say, about the outfit. And obviously somebody was told because they tipped the FBI, because the FBI was right there when they got off the plane. But the diamond was never recovered. Never found it. And I heard stories about that it was, where it wound up. It was cut up into several diamonds and sold in New York and in Los Angeles. But the diamond was never, ever found. And that was one of the largest diamond heists that took place at the time. And both guys went to prison. It was funny in that sense, but they had no diamond.
It's
And
crazy, isn't it?
Scotland Yard was all over it. Scotland Yard was all over it in London. And there was a lot of question about was the jeweler doing it for insurance purposes or what was really going on his end. That, I don't think that was the case.
So they go into prison for nothing in the end. There was nothing gained, nothing.
As far as getting back the diamond, I mean, obviously, if you're the jeweler, you want that 42 carat diamond back, but the diamond never came back. It was never found.
But that's what I mean, though. The two guys that went to prison probably never got anything either at the end of it all.
Well, the question is now, Rachel had always said later on, he told me the same thing he told others, that he got money for it, but I'm not too sure about what, because it was supposedly sent to his sister, and obviously she wasn't a jeweler, okay? So she had to unload it. And then got a pretty good idea of which jewelry store in New York it might have went to. But again, it was never found, and they were, and they never really had a strong case against them, but they had a case.
There was some when I was again, like as I continued to read the book, there was more and more things that just came up. And one of the things that you raised a good point about was a popular myth about the mafia and drugs. That actually, because kind of the heads of the family said no, everyone else just was dealing in it anyway.
It didn't matter. It didn't matter what the top said because the bottom was, it's always a conflict. It's like in a business, there's the conflict between the young employees and the older employees. The older employees have their way of doing it, and the younger employees come up and they've got their way of doing it. And what would happen would be the younger guys would go out and do drug dealing. And the older guys never really restricted it, as far as, well, we're going to do something. There's going to be retribution against the younger guys. And it never really happened. So that's why I always tell people when someone will say, oh, they didn't do drugs. I said, no, they were doing drugs for a long time, a long time, because they didn't want wars themselves within the families, especially the New York families, because they had so many. So verbally, that was okay. Yeah, we're against drugs, but don't get caught, that type of thing. So it was occurring, it was happening.
Well, it's interesting because what was it? Because it was something I started looking back into the Chicago mob and stuff, and in terms of sort of notoriety, it kind of just goes quiet after Capone. I mean, there's so many Wikipedia pages about who took over, what happened, but there was this general theme of they didn't like publicity and they kept very quiet and they kept everything under, let's keep everything under the lens. And it was the New York families that kind of became more folklore, in terms of the films, just being in the papers, being celebrities. What was it about the Chicago mob that made them change?
Well, basically, really the change started a little bit with Frank Nitti when he took over. Okay. It kind of continued, but where the real change came in 1943 when Tony Accardo talked to my father, and that's after the Hollywood case, and he was taking over and he'd run day-to-day operations really from 1943 to 1957, he ran day to day until Sam Giancana took over. And he always said, I don't want to be like those animals in New York. I don't want to be like them. He had no interest in them. He wanted a one-man rule, basically. Now, when Paul Rico got out of prison, the two of them ruled together, but there was no individual families. My father set up street crews. There were street crews, but the street crews always kicked their reporter back to Tony Accardo. So it wasn't like in New York, you have the five families, okay? So those are five individual families. And of course, because of that, you have a lot of problems because it's not a one-man rule. When it's a one-man rule, it's like if you own the company and you have 200 employees, but you're still responsible and they know it. They said, well, we know David's responsible, but if there's David, Scott, Bill, Sam, they start going off in their own tangents. And of course, New York families like publicity. At one time, New York had 9 newspapers. And because of that, everybody's looking for a scoop. Everybody's looking for some type of a scoop. So these guys played more and more into it. And you would saw it be handed down from generation to generation. I mean, you look at a John Gotti, and a lot of his problems was that he was very much in the news, okay? He made himself a target. And that's what Tony Accardo said with my father. I don't want to be a target. I don't want the family, the outfit to be targets. And they were later on, but it took a long time for that to occur. But he had no interest. I mean, right away he was putting when Paul Rica got out of prison, he put Paul Rica on the commission, New York, the mob commission, which there's 5 New York families. Chicago had a seat. They still have a seat. They're represented by the Genovese family. Chicago still has a seat on the mob commission. And then once Sam Giancana took over day to day, he got on the commission because Paul Rica didn't want any more of it. So it was, again, the idea of a one-man rule. I would say like kind of a one-man band. And for the outfit, it worked. I mean, it would work for everybody, but for the outfit, it worked because they kept that tight control and everyone knew that.
It's just you said like the seat at the mob commission. And what, if you're able to talk about it, what capacity does the mob exist today?
Well, there's still a mob commission, but the leaders don't meet. Okay? The leaders don't meet. In other words, the captain will meet with the underboss from one family or another, but you won't see the leaders meet anymore. That doesn't occur. Where at one time, that's who called all the shots. Everything worked from the top down. Now, basically, they'll talk to the leaders. A captain from, say, the Genovese family will talk to his boss, and maybe someone from, Genovese family will talk with Chicago because they're representing Chicago. Chicago doesn't actually have somebody on the commission, but they represent Chicago. But yet they'll talk with the leader of the Chicago outfit today, let's say, for example. So, they're still around. But again, when you lose the numbers that you lose, and some of these cities are extinct, there's some cities that you no longer have mob families. Some you still have, some are still very active. But some cities are gone. There's just not any mob activity. There might be other criminal activity, other gangs, from the Bahamas or different countries, Russian mafia, those things. But you don't have organized crime that people would identify with the mafia.
So was it just a sort of like just they just eventually just either sort of died out of natural causes or died out through their own causes? And they just
No, a lot of it, what happened was, see, some of the bosses in some of these cities never had the idea of trying to expand. They only work with a certain group. And obviously, when some guys went to prison, if you don't have somebody coming off the bench, what happens to the territory? What happens to the business? And of course, as time went on, you weren't getting people coming up in some of these other cities. In some of the cities, the next generation of young Italian guys, they were going to college and they weren't involved. But in some cities, they kept it so within a few people that once you started to lose the people, either by natural causes, by going to prison, by them just maybe retiring themselves, they reached a certain age and they moved to Florida and retired. All of a sudden, you just didn't have the numbers. Because if you don't have somebody coming off the bench to replace, it's like any other business. If you don't have somebody to replace the CEO, then what happens to the company? So it was the same thing with, because you got to remember, these areas and some of these cities were very small numbers to begin with, 20, 25 people, 30 people maybe. They weren't big numbers. They weren't like the outfit. They had 340 or, they didn't have that size. So you start to lose people. And if you don't have replacements, there it goes. And then once the FBI feels there's no reason to check on people, they don't check on people anymore.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because they had so many fingers in every pies, from one end of America to the other, north to south, west to east. And it's hard to believe, but like you said, every time a family, a head of a family got arrested, every time there was an informant, then the numbers just disappear because half the mob ends up in the prison or dead or goes and retires in Florida. And yeah, it's just trying to picture how that all worked, because it's the funny thing when I was reading the book that there's I want to say this without being, because I'm not sure how to say it without sounding rude, but they don't actually seem to be that smart, yet they also can smell money from 10 miles away.
Well, like I always say, like this, oftentimes guys were never good in a formal education, like with formal math. Okay. But you put them on the street and they understood how to make street money, which was a different math than what you would learn in school. And they understood that. They weren't smart guys. I mean, if they were smart guys, not that many would have been caught. But they weren't smart guys, but they understood how to make money. That's a big difference. I mean, you see that a lot of times, and you look at some of the major companies today, guys like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates. They went to Harvard, but they never graduated. They left school, but yet they have the ability to make money. They know how to make money. And that's what it's all about in mob life. If you were a good earner, you got some accolades, If you weren't a good earner, well, you heard about it real quick, because it's every the first conversation of the day is about money. The last conversation of the day is about money. But as far as intelligence, no. I mean, there were guys that maybe after 12 years old, that was the end of their education. They never even went to high school. So they were good on the street, but up to a point.
It's interesting because in the book you talk about how your father was just trying to go to the swimming pool to go swimming, and he got stopped by the boys, and it's just like, oh, you got to pay. And that's how he kind of started, was originally, and because his mum, he wanted to go to, my remembering this correctly, he got a scholarship and had the opportunity to go to college, and his mum's like, no, you've got to go out and earn some money, and that kind of sold his fate for him.
Yeah, well, that was it. Like I say, had he been able to go to college, he never would have went into life. It never would have happened. But because he couldn't, and in those days you needed money, and his mother did remarry, but the man she remarried had an alcoholic problem. He had five children. He was in the CAP union. He was an official in the CAP union in those days. But he wasn't that free with the money, and so my father's mother said, "Well, we need money coming in." So of course, if you don't have an education at that point or had a trade, and my father was very handy, he could have been a building superintendent even in those days, because my father could read blueprints. Because when I'd be with him in Las Vegas, he was reading blueprints. But he figured, well, he had met Sam Giancana. Sam Giancana knew how to make money. Go see him. That's how it all started. But had he gone to college, it never would have went that way. I mean, it was kind of like the opposite of what happened to Michael Francisi, okay, Sonny Francisi's son from the Colombo family. He's got a lot of podcasts and everything. Michael Francisi was a pre-med major at Hofstra University. He was going to college, but he listened to Joe Colombo. Okay, his father and his father, Sonny, was in the business already. And he dropped out of college, and from there everything went south. But I mean, he had great potential because, again, he was a pre-med major, so obviously he was an intelligent guy, and his whole life would have been different. He would have become a medical doctor. But he listened to what Joe Colombo was telling him because it was more glamorous when you're 19 years old and you can go to a place like the Copacabana, which was the top club in New York, and sit right in the front row. Okay, and see these top performers, figure, wow, you're getting in like for nothing. And all of a sudden, college isn't that important anymore. That's a mistake that he made because he did go to prison later. So, but he's a very smart guy. It was a shame.
Yeah, it's so how did, because that's the thing you did manage to navigate. What was it for you that didn't, that going to get a job, going to college, sold, it's like, no, this is the life for me.
Well, like I always say, first of all, I don't care that much for bologna, so I don't want to be eating the cuisine that they serve you in federal penitentiary. But basically, seeing everything as young as I was, okay, and kind of grasping it as I went along, obviously, because it was a lot, I realized what was going to happen to me had I pursued this, and it was not going to be a good thing, because I didn't have my father's ability. Though everyone told me I did, and they, would say, "Yes, God, you're as good as your father." I knew what he could do, and I knew what I could do. And again, if you have to be that type of person that's going to say, "Okay, I'm going to pay the penalty, but I'm going to go back into life, and this is what I want to do," just like if somebody wants to be an electrician or wants to be a plumber, or wants to be a school teacher, this is what they want to do. But in those cases, you don't have to worry about the FBI knocking on your door at 6 in the morning with a subpoena, okay? And you don't have to worry about being charged and being away from your family and all. But again, these guys became so indoctrinated because when a guy would get made, they would always be told, "We are your family." In other words, if they want you at 3 in the morning and you're sleeping, you got to come to them. We are your family. So they made it a family affair, but not a good family affair. But as a young kid, seeing all what I'm seeing, I knew what eventually could happen, because there's always somebody or something that'll trip you up.
So what is it you mean then when you say that you didn't have your father's ability?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, David.
What is it you mean when you said you didn't have your father's ability?
Well, my father had the ability. It's just like somebody, say a professional athlete, say maybe a soccer player, these great soccer players, they have abilities that the other soccer players don't have. Okay. And just like someone has, you put a tool in their hand and they're very handy. Some guys look at a tool, they can't do anything. And my father had the ability, he was really a natural. I hear that from Tony Accardo, I hear that from Sam Giancana. Your father's really a natural. I hear that from FBI agents, U.S. Marshal, IRS Criminal Division. When they said, "Your father's different. He's so different," because my father was a natural with this, because he understood how to do things and how to avoid things. That was the big difference. See, most guys never think about how do I avoid it? How am I going to avoid it? They'll talk about it, but they'll never develop a plan. This is what we got to do. That's what we got to do. That's why my father met in churches. He didn't want to go to restaurants. He'd use pay phones. He would do all different things that the FBI never thought was being done, because they couldn't put a tap on a pay phone. They didn't know what pay phone he'd be using, or what church, or what the Chicago Park District field house he'd be talking to, or what cemetery. So yeah, he was able, like he'd always say, it's a chess game. They make a move, I make a move. But guys don't think that way because the money overwhelms them. It's just like sometimes people, maybe you've known people that were friends, and one guy moves ahead in the company and the other company doesn't move ahead. And all of a sudden they separate because their friends are different now. And the same thing occurred.
Yeah, do you think there was, as you were saying that, it was making me wonder just your dad's ability to read the room with whoever was in it. Because throughout the book, there's lots of conversations where the higher ups liked his opinion. And he was very good at not giving his opinion, but making them think he had given an opinion.
Yeah, that was his skill. In other words, he would always say to them, "You're the boss, you make the decision, and this is what can happen, but you're making the final decision. You're going to make the decision." And they got to remember, as guys get older, they don't want to go to prison. And so his outlook was always, "Well, how are we going to avoid that, type of a thing? How do we work around that? How do And that's why they respected him. And again, because of Las Vegas bringing in 100 million out of the 200 million that the outfit was making at the time, yeah, they were seeing action. So it's like anything else. They always tell you, hit your wagon to a star.
Yeah.
And if someone's making 3% of your money, you're going to hit your wagon to that person. Okay, you're going to want to be with them. It's like if you're in a room and a multimillionaire or billionaire walks in, Everyone goes over and wants to talk to him because they think he's the smartest guy. A lot of those guys will say, I'm not the smartest guy, but I just hired people that are smarter than me to make me look smart. And, but, and that's how it'd be with him because they knew he could deliver. See, it's like anything else. If you could deliver in mob life, yeah, they trusted you a lot more. If you couldn't deliver, you might not see the sunrise.
That's yeah. I'm going to get into that in a bit because it's still something. Even though we discussed it a little, we may as well say get into it now because we discussed it a little bit before. Because the bit I cannot wrap my head around is how these guys can be best mates for 20 years, and then get an order. You're going to kill David today. You and I could have been hanging out since we were teenagers. We'd be 40 years old. You get the order to give
Oh,
me.
yeah.
To shoot me, you're going to do it. And it's not even a discussion. There's not even a hesitation. And
No, not at all. Because you see, once the order is given, I remember the first time my father told me, I was about 8.5 years old. He said, once the order is given, you've got to carry out the order. Otherwise, you become the next order. So it doesn't matter what the order is, it has to be carried out. Okay. And the only time I ever saw my father, I would say, hold back on an order was with Marilyn Monroe. And I think because she was a woman, that I'll tell you. And he kind of held back on that. He played around with it, Didn't he didn't carry it out quickly like it would carry it out on a guy right away. No, he kept telling Sam Giancana, okay, I'm looking at him, working on it, okay. Sam Giancana says, okay. He already given the order on her. But you knew that you had to carry it out because you'd be the next one. Okay. And the next one would happen. It wasn't just idle talk that we're just trying to scare you. No, you would be the next one. I see that happen. If someone didn't carry out the order, they were the next order. So guys knew right away if they were given the order, and not everybody in the outfit was the muscle. That's another thing. Not everybody was the muscle because not everybody can pull a trigger on somebody. Not everybody can kill somebody. So there were different responsibilities for different people. Like I say in the book, the actor. Some mob families had an actor, some didn't. But that he'd be the setup guy on a juice collection. The muscle would be waiting up, standing by the car, and the actor would tell the guy, if you don't come up with the money for me, next week, the guy outside is going to come and see you. But he's not going to talk to you like I'm talking to you, So that was always the setup. He says, he's not going to say a word to you. He's just going to come in and be physical with you. So that's when people got scared and they'd run upstairs and try and give him some type of money. Because as long as you bring in something, then it was okay. Because you could always stall and say, I'm getting the rest next week, but I got 25% today or 30% today. But if when you bring in zero, that's the problem. Because everything is about money. That's the problem. You got to bring in something. Even if you borrow it from your mother, bring in something.
It's so what was the mob? Why did the mob want Marilyn dead?
Well, it all went back, like I tell people, it all went back to the casino at Cal Neva. All went back to how the thing started with the Kennedys and the outfit. Okay, it all went back to that. Everything went back to that. Because it gotten so bad, it got so bad, it was Sam Giancana's way of I'm getting back at them. Okay. But everything had deteriorated so badly from when it started that it was actually beyond repair, to be honest with you. It was beyond repair. Because you weren't going to get the politicians, the Kennedys, to change their mind and do what they said they were going to do. And the outfit now was out for blood. Once the outfit would turn that corner, or any mob family turns that corner and looks for blood, it's over at that point. There's no going back. These guys don't go back and say, okay, you got a second chance. I never heard that. You'll hear that term. I believe in giving someone a second chance. Well, they never were in mob life. Okay. They never were in mob life. They never got no second chance. And that was a way of going back after them because they knew she was going after, John Kennedy. That's who she was interested in. So that was Sam Giancana's way. We're getting back. We're getting back. And then it went beyond that. Went beyond that.
Because I mean, Because I thought she, according to the press report, she allegedly died of, I say allegedly because you never know with these things, but she allegedly had an overdose.
Yeah, but they never see that. The thing is, they never did a toxicology report. They never did a toxicology on her. Okay. And when I met in 1975, I met Thomas Noguchi, who was the coroner at that time. And the one thing he didn't know that I knew and I had seen was that Marilyn Monroe, the pictures they had from Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who was the first on scene, was they had pictures of her. She had bruises on her body. Okay, on her arms and everything. So she was fighting back. So I asked Noguchi, why didn't you do, this was in 75, why didn't you do a toxicology? And he started stumbling around and I said, what about the pictures? And he said, what about the pictures? And his voice raised, what about them? I says, well, the pictures indicate that she's got bruises on her body. So she was fighting back. Okay. But I said, why didn't you do the toxicology? And he said, well, we didn't think that was needed at that time. He started playing around with it. So, but there was, like I say, more to it than that. Right? Sure, she could have died of that. They would have forced it down her throat. That's how they would have killed her. They would have taken the body and just forced everything down her throat and choked her, basically. But with him not doing the toxicology, I can't tell you 100% that that's how it happened. Okay. And why he did it. He never was honest, not only with me, with anybody. He always just denied it. Well, we didn't need it. That's what he'd say. We didn't need it.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's she was, allegedly died of a drugs overdose. There's no toxicology report. It's just like, okay.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. There's no toxicology. So how can you say someone died of drugs if you don't have a toxicology to show that the drugs were in her body? Okay. Now, I'm not, she was a drug user. Yeah, even when I met her in March of 1961, even on her final movie, the set, they were having problems with her with drugs and alcohol. And she was always a late comer as far as getting to work. But things were starting to really go bad for her. And I think a lot of it was because she was getting turned off by John Kennedy. That was happening. That was starting to happen. And so things were playing in her mind, I think, already at that point. But, like I say, it's one of those cases that, yeah, they said it was this, but there's no proof that it was that.
How did you find it when you met her? How did you find her to be?
Well, you have to remember when I met her and saw her, my father had already started to tell me about some of her background, not everything, but what it was like for her as a child. And that's the whole thing that you have to realize about Marilyn Monroe. Is what her child life was like and what was driving her to be an iconic actress, sex symbol, whatever you want to put in there. You had to understand what was driving. And after you'd hear her childhood, then you understood what was driving her to be trying to be the greatest. In other words, she would tell me, after she told me about her life, as a child, what went on, she told me whenever any movie that she did, that she would always get stills of that day's shoot and go back to the hotel and practice different poses in front of a mirror, see how much better she could make herself. It was always about, I did this on Monday, I want to be better on Tuesday. I did this on Tuesday, let me see what it looks like. I'll want to be better on Wednesday. That's what it was. But that was her child life. That was the driving force. There was no question about it in my mind, then or now. In either way, it was what was going on in her childhood life because it was so horrific. It was a very horrific child life. And then her father, her biological father, refusing to even acknowledge her. Not only I have any relationship with her, but he wouldn't even acknowledge her when she did finally meet him in Rhode Island. And that was very hurtful.
It is. It's a bit because obviously I was born in 74, so Marilyn Monroe died, but she was, as the Elton John song refers to her, she lived on, the legend lived on. But that it was always given that she had this aura about her, and you almost expect her to walk into a room and be 40 foot tall. But that's not what you saw at all.
No. That aura was just, there's this old saying that I remember Mr. T told me, Lawrence Taro, and I knew his brother was a Chicago cop. And when I first met Mr. T, he was a bouncer at this, it was a black club where like black men and women, there were business people, upscale type place. That's where I first met him. That's before he got into this competition and everything. But he'd always say to me, and using a Jewish term, everyone's got to have their own shtick. And he had his. And Marilyn Monroe created her own. Okay. She created her own. And that's what people, I would see that a lot of Las Vegas celebrities, they would try and create an image that it would help sell themselves to their fans, other people, and help their career. It was all about the career. Okay. It's all about, if you talk to any Hollywood executive or anyone who's making a movie, is he bankable? Is she bankable? That's what you're going to hear all the time. Las Vegas was the same way. When my father wanted to book Glen Campbell after he heard, the Glen Campbell song, and by the time I get to Phoenix, right away, he knew Glen Campbell was bankable. Others didn't, and there was a problem. But that's what it's all about. Create an aura about yourself that people want to see you. If you look at these people on TikTok, or you look at these people that have 2 million viewers on something, they're creating an aura to draw people. If you just get on there and say, hello, have a nice day, it was nice talking to you, goodbye, how many viewers are you going to get? Maybe a couple of whiners that hit the nail. What are you going to get? Somebody who stands out. Yeah, that's who they want.
It's fascinating because of the whole background with the Kennedys and Marilyn Monroe, and then to be to just be sitting in a room with her talking to her, and
Yeah.
because for people like me, she's a poster girl. That's and
Oh,
then
sure.
everything about it, and this sadly, she'll never understand how iconic she became, because, like I said, I was born in 74, and she was already had long died by then.
Yeah.
But she was this, she was a mystery, as well as being the poster girl for what a beautiful woman was. But she was also
Yeah.
a mystery. And then later in life, when the biographies come out, Wikipedia pages develop, and the internet is there, and you can read about these people, you realize that she was just horrible inside, not through any fault of her own, but there was nothing in there of beauty at all.
No, I think it was always, I got the feeling as I thought about it in later years when I was older after meeting her, it was kind of an empty feeling that she had. And a lot of it, of course, went back to her biological father, of course. That was really a big factor of this whole thing. Had he acknowledged her and said, I was wrong for leaving you, I want to have a relationship with you, which a lot of biological fathers or biological mothers will say when they meet their biological children. But him not to even acknowledge her, say, yes, I know I'm your father. No acknowledgement at all. Basically, I'm married now, call my lawyer, and walks away from her. And that was it. So he wouldn't even acknowledge her. And that hurt. Yeah, because her head
Because,
started to go down.
well, because this is it, isn't it? Because in popular myth, she was the perfect woman, the woman that every man should desire. If you're an upstanding heterosexual man, you will desire Marilyn Monroe. Every man should want her. So she has all this alleged beauty that everyone keeps telling her about. And you can imagine 99.9% of men just threw themselves at her feet, and would just never be like treat her like a normal woman. And then for all of this beauty, her dad is like, "You're nothing to me."
That's correct. That's correct. As far as her father was concerned, he didn't know her. He didn't want to know her. And basically get out of my life. I am married. I have my own family. You're not part of me, And obviously that's very hurtful. It would be hurtful to anyone. I know I bother me. I'm sure it bother you, your listeners, that your biological father does not want to have anything to do with you, whatsoever. And that was very hard for her. Okay. So again, she used that as a way to create an aura. Okay. Just like Playboy magazine, Hugh Hefner created something the same way. That's what my father wanted in 1959. He wanted to go after Hefner. Okay. He wanted to. And Sam Jean kind of says, the magazine won't last, you know. But he wanted to go after Hugh Hefner. And my father says, yeah, we can do it. We can do it. You know, and he said, well, how are we going to do it? Well, in those days, you had to have trucking companies do the distribution, okay? And the distributor, obviously, in hiring truckers, they were all Teamster drivers. So now you had a leverage, you had a hook of how you could stop his business, because a lot of places that sold Playboy magazine, like say in a grocery store, they had to put it in the back with a paper bag around it. They couldn't even have it out showing Playboy magazine. So, you know, there was these obscenity laws in some of these states, so it was harder for Hefner in some of these other states outside of Chicago. So my father realized, because at that point it was close to almost 7 million subscriptions a month. Okay, because again, it was the same aura. You know, Hefner's creating this image of the beautiful woman and the fancy cars and the clothes and the lifestyle you can have. It's like what kids see today. If you think about the show, let's say American Idol, it's a, you know, entertainment show. But how many of these people that win the contest, what happens to them afterwards? What happens to them afterwards? You start to think about, of all the years, you know, a few make it, sure, there's a few, but what happens to the guy who won last year, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, whoever won? What happened to them? Do you see them? And when I talk to young people, you know, in their 20s and stuff, I ask them about American Idol. They say, yeah, it's a nice show, but we don't listen to that type of music. Okay. So obviously, when they have these young people on singing music, they're trying to sing mainstream music for people to, you know, listen and want to enjoy and hear and support. But after they win the contest, what happens to them? And if you can tell me, then you're ahead, way ahead of me, because you don't see too many of them anywhere.
No, but because I guess part of their audience is an older generation that isn't going to go out and buy their music
Much,
anyway.
yes. Yeah, correct.
But
That's the
they
thing.
must
So
leave there thinking they're an A-class superstar because they've won the
that's
competition.
correct. Yeah, I just want American Idol. I just want American Idol. So now I'm going out. I'm going to go to Las Vegas. I'm going to go on tour. But then all of a sudden, a year goes by, 2 years go by, and you say, what happened to the guy? Well, he's back in his hometown cutting somebody's hair or something. You know, where is he? What happened to him? And the expense of putting someone on the road, if they don't have an appeal, these record companies and all, they're not going to spend that type of money unless you're bankable, unless you can fill a stadium. If you can't fill a stadium, they don't want you. You know, I mean, Taylor Swift, great performer, really talented, obviously. But if she couldn't fill a stadium, maybe she'd be a music teacher. That's about as far as it would go. But she can fill a stadium.
It's like a modern day mob. It's just it's legal
Yeah.
because they put it on TV.
Yeah.
If you're no good to them, see you later.
Yeah, that's it.
One of the things I again, how did they or what happened to the pension funds through the unions?
Oh, the pension funds, the one thing about the, see, like the Teamsters pension fund, this still works the same way today. They have the actual pension fund that's taken out for your pension, money's taken out for your pension, and they have the health and welfare pension, which is money that is put in, that's taken out for your health care. And that was the one thing when Jimmy Hoffa, when I was with my father when he met with Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa says, what are you going to do it for my guys? This is with Las Vegas when he got the loan. And my father said it'll create jobs, but he said, don't worry, who's ever supposed to get a pension will get their pension. Whoever has any medical bills, well, their medical bills will be paid. And that was always true. So no one who was a Teamster really knew what was going on with the money. They had no idea that was going on. Because you got to remember, in those days, a lot of the pay periods were every Friday. Then later would come the 1st and the 15th and the 1st and the 16th. So these guys were getting paid, but money was coming in every week. It was going into the pension funds. So whatever was going out was coming in. Okay. And my father was paying back the loan. The loan was supposed to be a 10-year loan. It got paid back in 5 years. Money was always coming in from the paychecks of Teamsters.
So the mob
So
did pay the money back then.
the
They always paid the loans back.
He paid the loan back. It was about 2% interest on the loan. Yeah, my father paid it back in 5 years. That didn't always happen a little bit later on, and that caused a lot of problems. Because
Because
guys got greedy.
because you alluded to that in the book, that people stopped paying back the loans from the union. And I was just like, well, how did that work then? Because especially for Chicago, the being lined up with the union was part of their strength, because if you didn't do something, they could order people on strike because they had the union on side that controlled the union. And I didn't realize until I read your book how much of they actually used union funds to pay, to start businesses. And so it's just like when I was reading, they didn't, later on they stopped paying the money back. Like, well, how the hell did that work?
Well, that was a problem because Jimmy Hoffa was under intense pressure at that point from the government. Okay, he was under intense pressure. So because of that, you didn't have that leadership at the top forcing it. Because normally the way it would work, when a wise guy would get a loan, say from the outfit, there'd be basically a contractual deal that would be drawn up that the Teamsters would get, became a 25% owner in the business or a 30% owner, and their books would be audited. So they'd get money out of the loan. Even if they weren't paying, say for some reason, they were still getting money out of the business. So they weren't losing any money. Under Hoffa, they weren't losing any money. But as time went on, when Hoffa had all his legal problems with Robert Kennedy and he wanted to kill him himself, those problems that started occurring, then you had a change of leadership that kept occurring on the top. You didn't have one strong leader. Again, it went back to Tony Accardo's theory of a one-man rule, where you had Hoffa was a very strong-willed guy. You started to have other guys, not that they weren't strong-willed, but they were being more dominated because they were put in by mobbed up unions. So they kind of listened to what the mob wanted them to do. If the mob says, well, we're not going to pay back the loan, they weren't going to argue with the mob because the mob put them in, because they knew if they had a problem with the mob, that's when there would be a car firebombing, there'd be their houses would be set on fire, maybe they'd be killed. So no, they didn't, they went along with the game. They went along with the game. And it changed. It changed a lot.
Because I mean, the mob always were given the blame for Hoffman disappearing. But how much of it? Because I mean, I only really know of Hoffman from what I read, and I didn't read anything about him until I'd seen The Irishman. And there's this, yeah. Well, okay. So you tell me.
Well, basically, what happened was this: when Jimmy Hoffa was being pardoned, okay, and it was a $300,000 cash pardon to Nixon. That's what it was, because we delivered it to E. Howard Hunt, who was a big involved in Watergate. He was the guy who organized the burglars. Okay, it was E. Howard Hunt, very cold guy, CIA guy, agent, and he had a very cold personality, very cold. Met him in a Jewish cemetery in Bethesda, Maryland, with $300,000 cash. The deal was that Nixon, okay, was going to pardon him, but he could not go for the union presidency. Okay, that was the deal. He couldn't go out go for the union presidency. He'd be barred from that. And Hoffa, sure, he agreed to it, but once he got on the outside, like anything else, that went out the window, and he wanted the union presidency back. And Frank Fitzsimmons was the union president at the time. He was originally a president of a local from Cleveland, which there's another story about there with the car bombings and him, and that's another story for another time. But Fitzsimmons was mobbed up, very mobbed up. And because they controlled Fitzsimmons, they didn't want Hoffa coming back. They didn't want him coming back. But Hoffa being Hoffa, he was not going to take no for an answer. He was one of these guys, my way or the highway, and my highway is the best highway. So he was coming back and trying to make a comeback, let us say. But he had no support really for the comeback. That was the whole thing. He didn't have support from other Teamster unions. They weren't supporting him at all. So, but he still kept going, still kept trying to pursue it. And that's when the problems developed. That's when things got serious, because he wasn't going to stop. He wasn't going to stop. So it was all mobbed up. Yeah, it was all mobbed up.
Because, but this is the things I find, like I said, and it's very easy to sit here when you're not the person involved, and you have to remember somebody like Hoffman didn't get
Hoffman.
where Hoffa, sorry, my apologies, someone like Hoffa didn't get where he was without a ruthless streak and ambition. You like, if he was never going to win, why take him out? But then the other side of the coin is, if the mob has told you, thank you very much for your service, you've made a lot of money, we're happy to take care of you a little bit more, but you're going to retire, how do you not think that'll end well if you ignore them?
Well, when you got to remember Jimmy Hoffa, when he was 18 years old, started out with the union, and he was the type of guy, if the union was on strike, he was out there with other guys with the baseball bats, and if you crossed the line, he was a head breaker.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Jimmy Hoffa. So to have that a personality to do that, okay, you have to have that type of a strength, I would say, in a sense that nothing is going to bother you, okay. Because you can be violent when it needs to be violent. That's why I say going back, not everybody could do this. Not
Yeah.
everyone could be violent. But he was 18 years old and he was not afraid. If somebody crossed the picket line, he'd grab him by the collar and give him a whack with the baseball bat. And then everyone would run back across the line and they wouldn't go into the factory. But, so he was that was his personality. If I got to get you, I'm going to get you, type of thing. So he always figured. Some guys figure they're bigger than the action. And Jimmy Hoffa kind of was that type of a guy. And he figured he was bigger than what the outfit was all, not the outfit, but what unions were about, everything. I'm bigger than you, and that doesn't always end well at all, especially when you've been away from the action for a while. You don't really have any friends or anybody that's going to support you. It's going to back you up. You don't have your own crew. I'd see this a lot when guys would get out of prison. Especially high-ranking guys. Sometimes they want to go right back. Some were able to, some weren't. Okay, and the guys that weren't, you never saw them again. And I'd say, Dad, what happened to Bobby? What happened to Tony? What happened to Davey? And he would change the subject. He would change the subject on me, which t was telling me, you're not going to see him again. And Jimmy Hoffa was that type of guy. If there was a fire, he'd be running right through the fire. He was that was his personality. And personalities are something you really have a hard time changing. Very rarely can you change this personality. What they are is what they are.
Because that there was there's a bit in the book, and it was a guy called Johnny, who there's quite a fair bit in the book about Johnny, and he was counting the money, and he met the girl, and the girl in the book later killed herself despite the fact she left Vegas, went to back to California, and met somebody else. And one of the things that troubled me about that was, again, there's this thing that I and I know I've kind of I'm flipping and keep coming back to almost the same question is, these guys are in the life, they know the life, and yet just do something like count the money and take a bit for themselves because they're trying to impress a girl. And that bit is human, that bit I can understand. It's just like, well, that's the sort of thing, but you're not dealing with a HR company. You're dealing with the mob. And it's and I really struggle to the point of my head imploding how somebody who's so clued up knows the mob better than the mob themselves does such a stupid thing, because there's no other outcome.
Well, you see it from the outside as being stupid. I see it from the inside of a guy whose personality is, if I can stall him, I'll get the money, I'll win the money back, as I emphasized. He'd always think
Yeah.
the real Johnny always thought he'd win the money back at the gambling table. He'll win the money back. And that was very common when guys would be at a racetrack. I'm going to win the money back. I'll win it back. I'll replace it. See that, so they thought they could cover that by just winning the money back and they'll put it back in. And zero will be 100 and we'll be all okay. See? And you have to remember a criminal mind, with criminal minds, they never think of the bad. They
Yeah.
never think of the bad. because I'm in charge, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. They never think of the bad side of it. And when you ask me a question of, of why I wouldn't go into life, well, I knew what the bad side was because I saw it at a young age. They didn't see the bad side until much later in life. They were much older than what I was. So they feel they can always defeat it. I'm going to win it. I'm going to cover, because a criminal mind thinks that way.
Yeah, because I mean, there's elements of that I understand, like the gambling addiction. The gambling addict always thinks he's going to win the next race. He's always going to fix win the
Oh,
next race. But this is a guy that would have witnessed hits. This is a guy that witnessed the best and the worst of the outfit from the inside. He was part
yeah.
of the racket. So there's how do you not know that? Do you know what I mean? Because, like I said, I understand the addict's mind. I understand the gambling mind. I understand the loved-up guy who's trying to impress his girlfriend. All of those, but he literally is the guy that has his hand on the trigger. How do you think there isn't a trigger for you?
Well, that's the whole thing, is the things you talk about, you're able to perceive because you don't have a criminal mind. When you have a criminal mind, I'm going to escape, I'm going to get away with it, I'll get the money back, because you all day long you're thinking about doing criminal activities. Okay, that's all you're thinking about, is doing criminal activities. You're not thinking about, gee, I got to get the report out by 4 o'clock because the boss is going to ask me at 4:30, where's my report? And you're not
Yeah.
working a legitimate job. So you're doing criminal stuff. So by doing criminal stuff, you don't have any perception of reality. That's a big thing. There's no perception of reality. The reality is, this is how we do it in mob life, and this is how I've done it for 20, 30 years in mob life, and I'm going to continue to do it because it'll cover me. There's no perception of good and bad. There's no good and bad, no, none of that. That only comes up when a guy is dying and wants the priest to give him absolution. And all of a sudden, then they're concerned about good and bad. Other than that, no. They could care less. They could care less. So I'll never forget, I'm with Lenny Strollin. He was a young boss from Youngstown, Ohio. And he says, "Scott, we'll go to lunch, and then I have to go to Sears. I got to look at a refrigerator." And I said, "Okay, fine." So we go lunch, and then we're going to see a refrigerator. And he's looking at the size, and he's asking, "How big is it, and how wide is it?" And it didn't, I guess, quite meet his specifications, and we're back in the car, and we go back to his house, and then my father and I leave, come back to Chicago. And I said, "Well, he said, "Did you have a nice time with Lenny?" And I said, "Yeah, we had a nice lunch. It was a restaurant. We went to Sears. He was trying to buy. You know why he was trying to buy the refrigerator?" And I said, "No, why?" He said, "He wanted to stick his mother-in-law in there for the winter." I said, "You're kidding." He says, "No." He said, "That was his mindset, because he was having problems with his mother-in-law. So he was going to dump his mother-in-law in there, like you're putting in pickled pickles or something, or beets for the winter, and he's going to put her in there and there, but he couldn't find the right size." So he never did it. This is the mentality, is when guys do criminal stuff, they don't know, they don't think about legality. They don't think about morality. None of that matters. All that matters is, where's the money? How am I going to get the money? And how can I make myself look good so the boss will promote me to become a lieutenant, become a captain? How can I move up? How can I move up? What can I do? And that's all they're thinking about. That's all they're thinking about.
What is the ranking structure?
Well, everybody, see, some families had different ranks, but with the outfit, they tried, like my Tony Caro took over, my father said, "Look, we don't want too much management." Like in New York families, the captain is a big, kind of a big deal. The captain gets staff, basically. If you're a captain, you've got guys under you, and you may be reporting to the underboss. Okay. And some families work with, most families would work with an underboss in a crew, and some ran with the consigliere, some didn't. But my father, with Tony Accardo, he said, "Look, we got to create possible jobs, possible openings. Otherwise, the guys are going to start trying to make their own openings." And that's what you would see. In other words, if a young guy figures he's got no way to move up, can't move up to anything, then he's going to start doing his own thing. And his own thing meant start killing people, because that's how you get rid of somebody. If you kill someone, you move up in rank. That guy's gone. Or if he goes to prison, he's gone. There's a job opening. And so he told Tony Accardo, said, "Look, we got to create openings." So that's how an underboss was created. That's why a consigliere was created. With the outfit, a lieutenant was about the next highest, and that would be about it. They never had captain rank, because captain rank would mean the person would have to have staff, and that's when you have internal problems. That's when you have mob wars. There's one guy's a captain, he wants to take over. He wants to be, you know, after the movie The Godfather came out, instead of calling the top guy the Don, which in Sicily they're known as the Don, everyone started calling him the Godfather, like from the movie, he's the Godfather. Everyone wants that top, because when you have that top rank, everyone's paying you tribute. So you're getting all these kickbacks. I remember in 1962, Sam Giancana was making $100,000 a month. A month. He was the top earner. $100,000. You think about 1962, what were people earning in 1962? I remember in 1960, a lawyer was average salary for a lawyer in Chicago was $8,000 in 1960. Okay. So 2 years later, Sam Giancana is making $100,000 a month. Okay. So yeah, that's why guys wanted to be top, because they get all the tribute coming in compared to what salaries were at that time. Houses were a lot cheaper. It'd be maybe $10,000, maybe a little less. Everything was a lot cheaper. When you have that type of money, then you can do things and run the show. So guys, that's what their goal was. That's what happened with Tony Spilotro. He started saying, oh, I'm going to run day-to-day operation. Well, that's like if you tell your boss, I'm going to go for your job, how long are you going to be on the payroll? Okay. But with the company, they might terminate you or lay you off. With the outfit, you got terminated in a different sense with the 22 with the silencer. That's how you get terminated.
Yeah, very, very differently, but still the same. There's a bit about in the book about Barry Tigerman, and I've written it down as the corrupt straight lawyer.
Yeah.
And it made me realize, but I don't understand it, is how many straight people worked for the mob. They weren't mobsters. It's like there's nothing
No.
about Barry that was a mobster, but he was, like you, the conversation that he had about going to Vegas. I need to clear that with my wife first, and it was just pure business. But something in the book that I noticed that he seemed to do is he navigated dealing with the mob whilst making a ton load of money with, property deals. And I was curious as to why the mob didn't want their share.
Well, basically, you have to remember there are certain things that the mob does not know. There are certain things that, and one of them is legal work. Let's start with that. But they don't pay taxes, so they don't worry about a CPA. They're not worried about that. Okay, but a lawyer, yeah, that's a different story. Okay. Either they might need him to represent him in court, or maybe to foreclose on a building, to go after a building. How can we do it legally? And because of that, they have to rely on certain guys because of that. And so a mob lawyer was always very well paid, okay, because he had a skill that they didn't have and they were never were going to have. Now, remember, you're talking about people at best were high school dropouts. Now, when someone would graduate from high school, when a mob guy graduated from high school, that was a big deal. Oh, that was really exciting. It was really a big deal. Tony graduated from high school. Wow, that's wonderful. But see, a mob lawyer, got to remember, they have the intelligence how to maneuver legally things for them that they can't do themselves. And it would be like how my father would always say, you'd always bring in the people in Las Vegas that knew their business and never micromanage them. Okay. Some people, when I tell them, well, my father works straight jobs, they say, well, how could he do that? How could he go back and forth with Las Vegas? I said, what he did was he brought people to run just the casinos, because the hotel people had to be, the owners of the casinos had to bring in their hotel people. That he would tell them. But he'd bring people in that knew about gambling. In other words, when Mayor Lansky tried to fight Fidel Castro and stay after 1957, okay, and eventually he had to leave, the guys who were running his gambling, because he had about maybe three, four small hotels. It was like a mini Las Vegas, really. That's what it was. My father knew all about that. Contacted these guys that I can offer you a job at the hotels in Las Vegas. And so he'd bring guys in who knew how to run casino gambling. So therefore, from Chicago, he could contact these people and they would tell him what is going on financially, how much they're making. Okay, he would have the messenger set up with them. They'd run it, but that was their business. They knew how to run casino gambling because the Alpha never really had casino gambling experience. Oh, maybe they might have had some behind the bar, some gambling, but I'm talking about actual casino gambling. That's a different story. It's not like a backroom operation. So you need somebody that knows how to run gambling. So that's why Tom, that's why he wasn't running up and back, between Chicago and Las Vegas, and he could work straight jobs because he had the hotel people running the hotel operation, and he had the gambling people who knew gambling, how to run casinos, running the gambling. Because once Lansky was out of business, that was really the end of Lansky in the sense of having any type of casinos anywhere or any type of gambling, that type of a gambling, casino type gambling. He never had that after that. And when he saw Las Vegas, what my father did, he wanted my father to work for him. And my father says, "No, my wife doesn't have any family in Florida, so no, we're not moving down to Florida." And that ended that. But that's why you bring in the people that know their work. It'd be like if you need someone to be your technical person, you're not going to bring in some guy who, say, drives a truck for Prime or something. You're going to bring in someone who's a technical person that knows what to do technically for you. Make your show flow. And that was the same approach. You bring in the people, don't micromanage them. You'd always tell me, because they're going to make you look good. But if you start to micromanage, that's when they're going to start leaving you. And then you got to start finding people. So don't micromanage. And that's how it was with the lawyers. That's why they use the lawyers.
So would they have known, though, that he'd built this big property portfolio? Or just wouldn't have
There was a
cared?
lot of ideas, but they never knew because, again, as far as the hotel casinos went, there were private owners who owned it. There were the hotel people who ran it. The casino people were run by somebody else. So as far as the Nevada Gaming Commission, they never really knew who my father was, okay? Because he wasn't there physically all the time. Where they're seeing him, they're taking pictures of him. So they really knew because the people who were running the places were professional people in their work, okay? Who you would expect, the hotel people, the casino people, you would expect them. That's why he was never in danger of going into the black book from the Nevada Gaming Commission, where others, they would wind up, Sam Giancana, Tony Spilotro, even 10 years after he was there, Frank Lefty Rosenthal ran the Stardust. Yeah, he had problems because they made themselves seen with guys. They were seen. I mean, some of the messengers who were ex-Chicago cops wound up in the black book. And the black book was you couldn't go into a casino. That's what the black book meant. And into a casino, the license was lost. Wasn't they didn't put you on suspension, they didn't fine you, they would pull your license, they pull the owner's license. So that's why they couldn't go in. But because they were seen as known associates, that was the story. That was different. That was the whole thing. One of the real Barry Tigermans, I'll never forget when I was a little boy and we're in Las Vegas, and he's got a roll of dimes. He's using a payphone. And I said to him, I says, "Well, I said, my father do that. He used would always do that." And he said to me, "That's who I learned it from, your father." Okay. So, because of course you're using payphones in those days, there's no wiretaps on a payphone like your home phone. Like these guys today, they get caught with their cell phones. They're talking on their cell phone, about this, they're going to do that. And the G is listening there on a wiretap. But again, it goes back to the mentality of the person. If you don't think you're going to get caught, you're not going to care about defense. Some guys in mob life, it's always about offense, never about defense. But defense can keep you out of prison if you have a good defense.
Keeps
You
you alive
don't?
as well. So, just to finish up, because I'm conscious of time again. I mean, effectively, for those that haven't read it, the book finishes obviously with the death of your father and stuff like that. But before that, just before that, there's you're getting married. You brought your future wife home, and you have an agreement with your dad that he won't ever discuss it. And that your dad will just always be a straight guy. So, and I've always been fascinated with how your dad allowed you to navigate the life with his blessing at the same time. Because, and I've often wondered, is that just because of his circumstances and how he got into the business, where it was much more about almost accepting his fate? And then, because of circumstances, your dad seemed to be, one of the impressions I get about your dad is he's, apart from the way he read the room and navigated the world, he also seemed to understand that this is my reality. Do you know what I mean? Like from a very early age, when he meets up with the boys because he's just trying to cross the road, when his mum tells him, you're not taking the scholarship, you've got to go and get a job, that if there was a bitterness or any sort of resentment, he didn't seem to show it. He seemed to just say, well, this is the reality of my world, so my job now is to make that work. It just seemed to be almost like, well, it's, business is business. It's just, this is the business I have to do. And that's, and am I wrong in that, or is that sort of.
No, and that was one of the reasons why I would always say I couldn't be like him, because things that didn't bother him might bother me. You know what I mean? And that was how he was. And that's why they respected him, because he took always a business approach. This is what has to be done. And when I went to see him, oh, I would say a week before he died, I'd say, Dad, I gotta ask you a question. He says, yeah, sure, Scotto. Because when it was me and him, I was always Scotto. When we'd be Say, if you were here, David, and he was there, he'd call me Scott. Yeah, go ahead, Scott. Oh, I don't have much time, so talk quick. And I'd say to him, I says, why? Why the life? I said, you could have been a building superintendent. You worked for an eyeglass firm, and the guy wanted to send you to become an optometrist, which in those days was only 2 years schooling. You did very well in that industry. I said, why this? And he looked at me and he says, everyone needs a hobby. I said, well, you could have picked something else as a hobby. And see, he, and the one thing about my father that made him, I think, unique in the way is he understood people. He understood people. In other words, if you were to tell him, I'm unhappy in what I'm doing, the first thing he'd say to you, well, what are your options? I'm not telling you to stay. What are your options? What are you good at? What can you make money at? What can you earn at? See, he understood people. And that was the big difference. In mob life, guys don't care about people. That's the thing. They don't care about it. All they care about is getting the money from the person, whatever it is, and that's the end of it. If you drop dead, they're still going to come and collect on the loan. Okay. They'll tell the kids or the wife, well, your husband owes me, $3,000. Where's the money? Okay. Maybe they'll make the wife sign over the house. Okay. So they didn't care. But in his case, business was business. And he would always tell me, never take it personally. Like he'd always say, you got to remember when people, other hosts say to me, he said, they'd say, well, you have a lot of different types of friends. My father, right from the beginning, would always say, they're never your friends in the life. They're never your friends at all. Just think of them as associates. It's all they are is associates. I'll never forget when we talked about the RICO Act, which came about in April of 1970. My father said to me, Scott, this is going to be the beginning of the end, where the rats are eventually going to start jumping off the ship. So he knew at that point, he said, the days of Omerta, the code of silence, are over. They're over. He said, you'll meet a guy once in a while who won't talk, but most guys, when they got find out they're going to do 85% of their time, yeah, they're going to start ratting out people. You watch and see. And over the next 30, 40 years, 50 years, that's what was really happening. Guys would rat people out. They didn't care. Omerta didn't matter anymore. They were looking strictly to take care of themselves. So they'd rat the boss out, or whoever their supervisor, whatever it was, they could get them lesser time. Yeah, they'd rat you out. Where years ago, no one would ever think about it. They would just take their time and that'd be it. So yeah, he understood people. That was his main thing. He really understood people. And it showed.
My last question is, when did you tell your family? Because obviously you've written the book, so everybody must know.
Well, the only time I told my nephew is the only one left in Chicago. He's my only living relative in Chicago. Okay, it's my nephew. So I was never married, never had any children out of wedlock or any of that stuff. And it was funny because I sent him a copy. I never told him I was writing the book because I didn't think I could publish the book. That's the first thing. You know what I mean? It's one thing to say, yeah, you're going to write a book, but can you publish the book? And it goes back to what I saw in Mob Life, you know, basically, can you do it? But once I had a publisher, Dorrance Publishing, and the book was actually published, and I had a hard copy, I mailed it to him, I sent it to him, and he gets on the phone and he calls me, he says, "But Grandpa loved me, didn't he?" I said, "Yes, he did. He loved you very much. But Grandpa had a different life that he didn't want anyone else to know, because basically he didn't want you to start throwing his name around as you got older. Say, well, you know, my grandfather is, or my grandfather can do this to you." It'd be like Frank Sinatra when he would say, and guys got hot about this. When he'd say, "You know, I can have your legs broken." Guys didn't like that. They didn't like it at all. Some guys would tell him, "Don't say that. Don't you say that anymore." So a lot of times, you know, he'd hold back. But that would be after he had a little too much Jack Daniels to drink. Okay. But, you know, that was the thing, see. And then my nephew said, "Well, what type of life did you have?" And I told him some of the things. I didn't tell him everything, but I would tell him some of the things that went on in my life. Okay. And he said, "Wow, things were tough." I said, "Yes, they were. But Grandpa wanted me to see everything, because he'd always say, life is never easy. But if you go in with your eyes open, at least you know what you're going into." He said, "It's like going into a swimming pool and you close your eyes. Are you going to hit the water? What are you going to hit? But if you see the water, you know you're going into the water." And that was his approach with me. A lot of people have been critical about it. "So your father was terrible. He was this." But then again, I've seen a lot of people that were unhappy because they never ever learned about things in life.
No, I mean, when I think about, and obviously I have thought about this because I have an admiration for your father because of the, like I said, he didn't seem to hold a bitterness or a grudge about what he had to do to survive. He didn't seem to hold a grudge towards his mother. He just seemed to understand that this is my reality. So how do I make my reality work? There never seemed to be this, oh, if my life had just been different, I could have been X, Y, or Z. If the dice
Oh,
had
sure.
just been different, it could have been X, Y, and Z. It seemed to be, no, this is, I live in a world where my mum has told me, that's great, we're really proud of you, but it's not happening. You need to go out and earn some money. And he found his niche, if you like. And I don't mean it to say he was just, okay, well, this is how it is. He accepted it. He just seemed to understand that that was Chicago at the time, and that was the street he was born on, and this is the life I'm going to live.
Yeah, he understood his surroundings.
Yeah.
I mean, he understood his surroundings. And you have to remember, Chicago is a very political town. It's still very political. I mean, in my lifetime, there's been four governors who have been convicted. There's been 38 aldermen that have been convicted. 38th was convicted in December. He was a Democrat. A former Republican was convicted in February for taking money out of his campaign fund. So yeah, Chicago has been political. It always will be political. It just, as my father would say, the faces change, but the nonsense remains the same. So it doesn't matter who's in there, it's going to be the same.
I mean, another way I think would probably be another analogy for the way that the impression I get of your father. If your father was one of these guys that was going through college and had the potential to be first draft in the NFL or the NBA or something, but he suddenly twisted his knee getting off the bus and that's his career over, he'd have probably gone on to coach the team instead. He didn't seem to be the guy who's going to spend the next 40 years of his life crying about the fact he fell off the coach, fell off the step, and twisted his knee and ended his career. He'd just, no, the career's over. Right, what next? He just like,
My
this
father,
is the world.
My father would never said, "Scott," always he'd say, "Scott will remember this. No one likes a beefer." Ooh, a beefer means a complainer, a whiner. No one likes to hear that. Okay. And you have to remember, you're driving the bus of life. Wherever you take that bus, it's you. No one is forcing you. No one's putting a gun to your head to do this, to do that. You're driving the bus of life. And wherever you take it, it's on you of what you're going to do. And that's how he was with me with Mob Life. That's why he said to me, "You'll see everything and make your own decision." But yeah, he was not a type of guy, he said, because no one likes to hear a beefer. And you hear that all the time from people. "I could have been. I could have been. Yeah, I could have been this. I could have been that. I could have been." the next David Frost. I remember in the 1970s, some guy gets on television from England, says, "I could have
Yeah,
been
it
another
was.
a David Frost." But you weren't a David Frost, and you weren't going to be a David Frost, okay? And that's how he was, because he said, no one likes to hear a complainer, a beefer, okay? Because everyone has their own life. They made their own decision. If they don't like what they're doing, he said, you got to remember, the sign still says America. And that means you can change your job. You can do whatever you want to do if you want to do it. If you want to sit and complain about it, yeah, you're going to do that. But if you have the drive in you, he said, you got to have the drive. If you don't have the drive, then don't complain, because it's on you. You're the bus driver. You're taking the bus of life. So don't complain that somebody held me back. No, you put the keys in the bus and you put the car in drive and you're going. And if you don't like it, go down another street, go down another corner, but do it. But if you don't have the drive, you're not going to make it. And when you look, David, at people that have been very successful in the business world, in sports, entertainment, you name the field, very, very expensive, well done. It's always people who have that drive in them. Started the company in the basement, started the company in the garage, maybe got their mother to give them the 500 bucks to get the company going and became multimillionaires or billionaires, let us say. But they had the drive. And that was the difference between my father and a lot of guys in the outfit, is they wanted things handed to them. They wanted it handed to them. And he said, it's not going to work that way. He said, if you're lucky enough to be a child of a wealthy man or a wealthy woman, then it'll be handed to you. Okay. And if he was alive today, if you win the lottery, yeah, okay, it's handed to you. But Scotty said, the world don't work that way. And if you don't tell your kids that the world don't work that way, if you want something, you got to really go out and have that drive for it, they're going to get very hurt over time, because they're going to say, Dad, we had such a good life. And you'll say to them, yeah, we had a good life, but your life stopped after you graduated college. You didn't keep that drive up and carry it forward and take it forward and take that bus of life somewhere. And that's how he felt. He was not a beefer or a complainer or a whiner. He wasn't. It was never that way. He never felt that way. Even if something wasn't going right, he'd always say to me, Scott, never concede. Never concede anything until every option is explored, every option is done. And even if, once that happens, start thinking about, can I create another option to give me an opportunity? Don't just give up. Don't just, I mean, how many times do you see people? I'm sure you've known people. Well, then I've had people tell me when I was trying to get Inside published, I had, 20 rejections on it. Some people told me, boy, after the first or second rejection, I would have stopped. I've heard that a lot. I never would have went any farther. Okay. And I look at them and I'd say, you didn't have a mobster as a father. I'd be thinking, I wouldn't say it, but that's what I'm thinking. Because he would tell you, hey, put the car in drive and go. See, and keep going. That's what I did. I'll never forget one day. It was probably in, like maybe January of 2013, maybe 2014. The weather, the daytime temperature was 4 below 0. Okay. The nighttime temperature, I come back from dinner, was 7 below 0. And in the doorways was the same FedEx box with my manuscript that I had sent out that was returned. It was never opened. And it was very cold, as you can imagine, that day. But I get up the next morning, I'm at the FedEx office, send it out to this one, send it out to that one. And the lady behind there said to me, Scott, don't ever give up. And I can see you're not going to give up. And I said, no. Even now, I mean, people say this should be a movie. Sure, it should be. There's a lot. And maybe it won't go no farther. Maybe it's a fool's dream on my part, but I'll keep pursuing it as much as I can. Get the interviews, try and meet people, whatever I can do, because I always believed in Inside. I won't stop with it. But that's just me. That's not everybody.
And that's a brilliant place to stop. Scott, thank you ever so much for your time. I really, really do appreciate it. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. And if you see the Marlboro Diamond, say hello for me.
Yeah, definitely. Most definitely.